Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes New York Times bestselling author Laura Lippman for the launch of Sunburn, a superb novel of psychological suspense about two people locked in a passionate yet uncompromising game of cat and mouse with dark secrets, forbidden desires, inevitable betrayals, and cold-blooded murder. Friday, February 23rd at 7 p.m., more at theivybookshop.com or call 410-377-2966.
Hello again from the Baltimore Sun. Dan Rodericks here, Sun columnist, and this is Roughly Speaking. It's the 12th day of February 2018. Today we're looking at headaches from aging infrastructure in the Baltimore metro region, a subway system that has to be shut down for a month, and a water and wastewater system in need of costly repairs, causing bigger and bigger water bills to come due for Baltimoreans, many of whom cannot afford to pay them. We'll get to the water bills part of this episode later on. First, the Maryland Mass Transit Administration has shut down the Metro subway to make emergency repairs to the system. Problems were discovered late last week, and over the weekend, thousands of daily commuters have been inconvenienced by the sudden closure, and the state has had to hire extra buses to help people get between Owings Mills, northwest of the city in Baltimore County, to downtown. Reporter Colin Campbell has been covering that story for The Sun. Colin, can you explain why all of a sudden we have an emergency repair that's going to take a month and shut the whole system down?
Repairs were planned to take place this summer, and the MTA took a look at the system and basically said that they found an urgent need, an emergency need for repairs immediately. And they didn't want to put any riders at risk. And so they wanted to shut down the whole system just as a precaution.
A recent inspection then led them to this decision?
Yes, that's the summary of what they've told us.
Have they been with reporters specific about what the problem is?
That's been a little more difficult to suss out. I've asked specific, give me on a granular level. You're shutting down the full system. What specifically is the issue here? Are we talking about the rails coming apart? Are we, underground fires? What is causing this emergency?
And where between
shutdown?
Owings Mills and the Baltimore City, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So what they told me was that basically the rails just in 36 years of being used, they are just wearing down. They say they measure the height of the rails and that they're just being run over again and again, as you would imagine over that length of time, do wear down. They said that it was several points in the above ground section of the track northwest of the tunnel of, the Mondawmin station. Mm-hmm. And then once they realized they had a need to make repairs in the outside parts of the track, they then decided, well, while we have the whole system shut down for that, why don't we take a look at the inside portions of the track as well to just see full system check. Let's see what needs to happen. And they said that during this weekend, when they looked at it, they realized there were sections of the underground tunnel track as well that needed to be replaced immediately.
Wow. I mean, 36 years, the whole system is 36 years old, right? Theoretically, that could be a lot of rail that needs to be replaced, right?
The original track is 36 years old, I believe, and then the subsequent levels of it, there were subsequent legs that were added afterward.
Okay. During that period, that history, there might have been times or places where they replaced rail?
Yes. Yeah.
So it's not like they have to replace the whole system. They're just specific areas.
Right. There are specific sections of track that they said were more worn.
And their estimate is this will take a month's time and be completely shut down to 40,000 riders.
Yeah, 40,000 rides a day.
Let me check something with you. Is it 40,000 riders or rides per day?
Rides per day.
Okay, good. Thank you.
They normally take, and those will be replaced by a $2.2 million bus bridge is what they call it. It's basically buses, coach buses that are going to run for free along the metro route. Now, riders who came out to use that bus bridge in several cases told me that it did not quite do what they were hoping in terms of getting them to work on time. First of all, the first one's just a logistical thing. Moving through downtown's a lot quicker when you're going through a tunnel than when you're going through lights and morning traffic.
Yeah.
But the other piece of it was that in some situations, for instance, when you start a bus at Owings Mills and you bring it downtown, picking people up the whole way, as you might imagine, when it gets to Milford Mill or Mondawmin, it's full of people who are headed downtown. So I had some riders suggest that more buses be launched at the same time or be launched
at different areas.
At different areas, so mm-hmm. to start it at Milford Mill or to start it at Mondawmin, so that you know the buses aren't arriving full to people who have been waiting.
Did the MTA say what it's going to do about that? Is it going to stagger the bus system?
Kevin Quinn, who's the MTA administrator, did say that he had gotten feedback from riders, from folks in the MTA who have been working. They did station folks out at, you know, some MTA, what they call transit ambassadors, out at some of the stations to point out, hey, here's where the bus is going to come, stand on this side, you know, here's how frequently they'll be coming, that type of thing. So they did have some folks out there, and he said that they had a sort of a follow-up phone call today after the morning rush to say, hey, you know, how did it go? What could we improve? That kind of thing. And he told me that that's one of the things that they're looking at.
When you spoke to riders today, were they still kind of a little bit in shock that this happened so quickly?
Yeah,
I mean, it was announced when? On Friday or Saturday?
So on Friday, they shut down the whole system and said, we need to make significant repairs on the northwest leg. This is again the above ground section of track. And then while they had the whole system shut down this weekend, they said, why don't we do a full system check and check the tunnel as well? And that's when they discovered that there were issues inside the tunnel that needed to be remedied as well. One sort of side note is that even if there weren't issues in the tunnel, you can't really just run the trains in the tunnel because they need to be able to access the maintenance yard, which is in part of the above ground section of the track. So it definitely will expand what they need to do because obviously if you have more track that needs to be repaired, that's more work. But it sounds as though the whole system would probably have been shut down either way.
And the plan was to shut down the whole system.
Well, I'm not sure.
In the planned repairs that they were thinking of.
I'm not sure exactly how they plan to phase that in.
Oh,
we haven't really had those conversations.
That involved a full system shutdown or not?
Yeah, okay. I don't. If it did, they haven't. You know, they hadn't communicated it.
Did the Maryland governor Larry Hogan have anything to say about this?
So Governor Hogan blamed underfunding of the system. He said that it had been drastically underfunded for 30 years, and said that that contributed to the need for these urgent emergency repairs. Administrator Kevin Quinn has cast the repairs in more of a
standard maintenance
type of way. He's said, you know, hey, this was a thing that needed to happen. It happened a little earlier than usual. We wish we could have given riders more notice, but this was something that was in the cards all along.
So the state is paying what and whom to run buses? This is a private bus service?
Yeah, they hired two firms to provide bus service along the metro route for a combined $2.2 million over the course
of the month.
Over the
month. Yep. And that's assuming this only takes a month. Right?
Yes. And one thing I should point out, the MTA has said that they will consider situations when possible of reopening parts of the system before March 11th when the full system is set to reopen. But they haven't really discussed specifically what needs to happen between now and then.
Colin, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
That was Sun reporter Colin Campbell. You can find his stories about the metro closure at BaltimoreSun.com. Now let's talk about water bills. As the Sun's Luke Broadwater reports, hundreds of customers of Baltimore's water system were hit with bills of more than $50,000 each. Can you imagine getting a bill like that at home? The Baltimore Department of Public Works said Thursday that officials are reaching out to 566 customers who were sent the bad bills. City officials blame the incorrect bills on a weekend software upgrade that created problems. Well, that's one of those mildly amusing stories about municipal dysfunction. The problems with Baltimore's superb but needing big love water system go far beyond computer glitches. City Hall and the Department of Public Works are wrestling with fixing the water and wastewater system, a costly ongoing project, while collecting ever-rising fees from residents, many of whom can't afford their bills. Roger Colton is a Boston-based economic consultant who has studied utilities around the country and who studied Baltimore's books. In a 109-page report, Colton concluded that as more and more people can't afford to pay, the city could find itself in a downward spiral, forced to impose larger and larger price increases to pay for court-ordered infrastructure upgrades.
In the report, I looked at a couple things. One is dollars that the city of Baltimore will be spending on environmental compliance costs, primarily in response to a consent decree that the city signed with the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. Mm-hmm. And those dollars are in the billions, not simply the hundreds of millions, but in the billions of dollars. I then looked at the impact that those dollars are having on rates, the extent to which the Department of Public Works is really translating its billings into actual revenue. So as the rates and the bills go up, we know that bills have tripled in Baltimore in recent years. We know that the receivables, that the unpaid bills for DPW have skyrocketed as well. And indeed, the receivables are going up more quickly than the bills are going up. And what that means is that DPW, even while it's increasing its rates and its bills, it's not receiving a corresponding amount of increased revenue. And the reason for that is what I looked at finally. The reason for that is that Baltimore has a very substantial low-income population, and I looked at the affordability of bills on a very small basis. I split the city of Baltimore into nearly 200 different areas called census tracts, and found that by 2021 and 2022, that more than half of those census tracts are going to be facing unaffordable bills. So we know that Baltimore's got a problem. We know why they've got a problem, why the city has a problem, and then I proposed a solution for that problem.
Without getting too deeply into the weeds on methodology, how do you measure affordability? What is affordability based on?
Affordability is based on what are called bill burdens, and what that is bills as a percentage of income. So to use a very simple example, if somebody has an income of $10,000 and they have a water bill of $1,000, and I'm just making up numbers here, mm-hmm. they would have a bill burden of 10%. We know that burdens for water that exceed roughly 3% of income have been found to be unaffordable, and that's based on national and international standards.
Based on what you found, it sounds like some households, or many households, are just opting not to pay the full bill or pay the bill at all.
Well, I wouldn't say that they're opting not to pay it, but people who are receiving unaffordable bills generally don't pay the entire bill. Mm-hmm. They don't pay the amount that's unaffordable. But in addition, what experience shows is that if somebody is going to face the disconnection of service, whether they owe $40 or whether they owe $20, there is no incentive for them to pay the extra money. So if they receive a $100 bill and can afford to only pay $40 of it, there is no incentive for them to pay any of it, because even if they pay a part of it, they're still going to face the loss of service. And thus, when utilities begin to address the affordability issue, and this is a water utility or an energy utility, either one, the customers not only pay more of their bill in percentage terms, but they pay more of their bill in absolute dollar terms as
wow.
well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not theoretical. That's been found to happen with similar programs around the country.
So if people receive bills that they think they can pay, that seem more feasible, right? $40, not $100, or you mentioned in your example $1,000 for someone who has an income of $10,000 a year, just as a hypothetical, but, you know, if that bill were $150 or $200, they're more likely to pay that full amount?
Yes. The technical term is called the bill payment coverage ratio, the percentage of the actual bill or the percentage of the bill that is actually paid. When people receive an affordable bill, they will more likely pay that entire bill. And what the utility finds is that not only does the percentage of the bill that gets paid increased, but the absolute dollars of payments that the utility is receiving increases as well. I did some work in Denver, Colorado, and the Denver utility, PSCo, Public Service Company of Colorado, found that even though they were giving their low-income customers participating in their affordability program a discounted bill, those low-income program participants were paying 110% of what the low-income non-participants were paying.
Wow.
So the bill was less, but the revenue was more.
Right.
What happens is that not only does the utility collect more money, but it works less hard in the process of collection
as
well.
Right, I get that.
One of the problems with unaffordability is that the utility is spending money trying to collect a bill that people are incapable of paying. So they're really, that the money spent on the process of collection is really money that is not well spent.
Well, it sounds like, based on what you've come up with so far on Baltimore, looking at the years ahead, that this is not sustainable.
The city of Baltimore, Baltimore Water, the DPW, is going to face real problems. In fact, it's already facing real problems. If you look at the city's financial statements look at the numbers that the city reports for the receivables for water, what are called service billings for water and for wastewater or sewer, the receivables are skyrocketing. And the problem is that the city has an obligation under the consent decree to invest in the environmental compliance. That is non-discretionary. So the city really needs to address the ability of the water and sewer system to generate the money. And it's one reason that the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, which is no particular fan of low-income customers, they don't have any particular interest in the social justice issues involved with the affordability or the unaffordability of water rates. But the Environmental Protection Agency, when it was looking and issuing guidance to the states on determining the financial capacity of communities to do environmental cleanup, recommended, and recommended low-income discounted rates. And in fact, not only recommended it, but the language the EPA used when it issued its guidance was that it strongly encouraged communities to adopt a low-income rate. And again, that was simply the use of low-income rates as a tool to make sure that cities could generate the dollars that are needed to invest in environmental cleanup costs.
This is why the billing picture has changed here in the last few years in Baltimore. If people don't understand it, they'll understand it just by listening to this podcast, that it's clear that the bills go up because there's more infrastructure to pay for, repairs that need to be made. For years, Baltimoreans and people in Baltimore County who get the municipal water, you know, got water through a substandard system or wastewater system that was substandard that polluted the bay. So we're paying for something that's long overdue. In case you looked at it in your study, where's the relief? Are just the ratepayers, the customers of the water system, supposed to pay for all of this? Isn't there any other help that's available from the state or federal governments?
I think there probably is not. In fact, one of the problems is that a lot of cities, and the city of Boston, where I live, has faced the same problem. The city of Boston was ordered to clean up the Boston Harbor, one of the dirtiest waterways in the country. And by the time the city got around to being forced to do that, the federal money that had historically been available was no longer available. So these cleanup efforts today are being done exclusively on the backs of ratepayers. And then we add on to those environmental compliance costs the fact that the water and sewer systems for these major urban areas that are simply old and wearing out. And that's not a criticism of anybody. It's simply an indicator that Baltimore is an old city. Boston is an old city. The water and sewer infrastructure, the pipes themselves, are 100 years old, and they have to be replaced. Unfortunately, the ratepayers are going to be given the bill for replacing that. I don't think it's reasonable in today's political environment to think that the federal government is going to step up in any significant way to help municipalities pay for these systems.
Is anyone at City Hall reading your report, paying attention to what you've come up with?
I would say that there is considerable support and even enthusiasm on the city council. I didn't have an opportunity to speak with anybody in the mayor's office, but the city council members now understand that, unlike what they might have thought in the past, where people hear low income and they hear unaffordability and they think social problem, that the unaffordability of water in Baltimore is more than a social justice issue. It is a social justice issue, but in addition to being a social justice issue, it's a business issue from the perspective of the water utility and the wastewater utility, and a business issue from the perspective of the city itself. And adopting a low-income rate is the most reasonable way forward to address both the social justice issue and the business issue.
By sending bills to people that they can afford to pay.
Right. Yeah, you can't squeeze water out of the proverbial stone. You can bill somebody 20% of their income all you want, but you're simply never going to collect that bill. So if you want to send a bill and actually receive the money that is included in the bill, that bill needs to be an affordable bill. People have to be capable of paying the bills that you're sending.
That was Roger Colton, an economist, utility affordability expert, and an independent consultant with Fisher, Sheehan, and Colton. He did a pro bono report about water affordability in Baltimore. You can find a link to that report in the notes with this podcast. That's our show for now. For producers Steve Early and Quinn Kelly, I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and you'll be hearing from us again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.